Yeah, so thanks to George for the invitation, and so it's nice to have an excuse to come to Fields, even though it is on a Saturday morning. Still nice. So a little advertisement. I'm organizing the day before the Canadian Operator Symposium this year in Waterloo. I'm organizing a one-day workshop, operator algebra workshop in Guelph, and so it's going to be small and mainly non-self-adjoint types, but you know, not exclusively, and anyone's welcome. So let me know if you're interested. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the so non-self-adjoint graph algebras, basically. But I'll start off general and try to give a brief introduction to the class. And this specific work I'll be talking about is kind of spread, I guess, through joint works with Elias Katsoulis, Mike Jury, and Stephen Power. Okay. All right. So the starting point, I mean, the setup for these sort of directed graph operator algebras, is that you start off with your directed graph, okay, and the only consistent assumption we make, at least in our work throughout, is that it's a countable directed graph, and then there are constraints you can put on here and there depending on what you're trying to do. And so basically what you want is a family of partial isometries, one for each directed edge, and projections, one for each vertex, which satisfy these relations, which are kind of they're spelled out by the directed graph. Okay, so for instance, you want the vertex projections to have orthogonal ranges. You want the partial isometries for directed edges to have orthogonal ranges. You want the initial projection for each partial isometry to be equal to the source projection for that directed edge. And then this last condition, you want basically all the whenever you have a directed edge that goes into a vertex, you want the corresponding range projection for that partial isometry, SE star, to be supported on the corresponding vertex projection, the vertex projection that corresponds to the range of that directed edge. Okay, and so let me call those the dagger relations, and say double dagger when you get equality in the fourth condition. You know, so these are the basic relations. There are lots of special cases which restrict things. I mean, for instance, in the C-star setup, you're generally looking at you generally make a finiteness assumption. So if you want these sums to be in the C-star algebra, you want them to be finite sums of projections. So there's a natural C-star constraint. And okay, so for example, I mean, to be a little more explicit, but still very hand-wavy. So here's an example with so two vertices, three directed edges, E, F, and G. And so the edge set is E, F, and G. The vertex set is X and Y. Thanks. So to establish some notation, I'll need this later on. I'm going to write, it just turns out to be convenient, in at least in what I do, to have to write the, so if F, so F starts at X and ends at Y, right? So I want to write the source vertex of F as on the right of F, okay? And so, and then the S and R are the source and range maps in the directed graph. And so, you know, however you're going to do it, you're going to get to either an abstract or a concrete representation where you get to, in this case, three partial isometries, S, E, S, F, S, G, two projections, P, X, P, Y, and they're going to satisfy the dagger relations. And then the game here is to study the operator algebras that you get generated by such a family, you know, closed up in the norm, or weak operator topology, or a non-self-adjoint, or possibly putting in the adjoints and getting the C-star algebra. So depending on who you are, your basic philosophy governs the type of algebra you look at. But that's the basic setup. And so I guess in a more general colloquium talk, I would well, this is still on the slide, so I'll say it, but this is kind of, so Palle Jorgensen has this fun article in last year's AMS Notices on, it's on a whole bunch of things. He's making connections all over the place, but he talks about directed graph operator algebras and how the relations that generate them have really been studied for a long time in different forms, for instance, in engineering for decades. Okay. So the C-star algebras then, the C-star algebras, okay, I'm going to be simplistic and just say, you know, philosophically this is more abstract, okay, and so in particular when the SE, when you're given such a family and if they satisfy the double dagger relations, then the C-star algebra generated by the family is a Kunz-Krieger graph algebra, okay, or called a Kunz-Krieger graph algebra. And when you have dagger but not double dagger, okay, in other words, that that last condition is can be strictly less than, okay, the last condition in dagger, then the C-star algebras there are called Kunz-Krieger Toeplitz algebras, okay. And given G, there is a universal C-star algebra, C-star of G, for the double dagger relations, and so this is much studied in the last few years, and so there's some of the principal investigators, but there's a whole host of people that have been involved. And so for example, I mean, I'm not going to say anything more about C star of G, but in the case of a single vertex graph and a single loop edge, you get continuous functions on the unit circle, and then a single vertex and two loop edges, you get the Kunz algebra, and of course single vertex and n loop edges, you get O(n). Okay, so in that sense, they're generalizations of the C star of G in general is a generalization of the Kunz algebras, if you like, for more interesting graphs. Okay. So the non-self-adjoint perspective then, I guess, is and again, to be simplistic, you can think of this as being more concrete. So the perspective now is you care more about the particular representation, or at least the underlying Hilbert space. But I'll make a point later that you can show you can still prove universality type theorems. But yeah. Anyway, the important example here, and actually it turns out to be an important example in the C-star theory, is what you get from the natural Fock spaces that that every directed graph determines. Okay, so F plus of G is going to be the what we call the semigroupoid of G, and apparently semigroupoid is a controversial term, but we use it, and well, I'll blame it on Steve Power. Okay, so it was, I was, when we started looking at this, I was the well, I still am the younger person, so I didn't have a choice in the terminology. Nothing. Yeah, so that's the controversy. Oh, right, yeah, so finite paths, yeah, so finite paths in G, that's right, yeah, so everything directed, yeah, and so the semigroupoid then is the directed paths, the directed finite paths in the vertices, and there's a semigroupoid structure, a pre-groupoid structure there, and indeed there's a groupoid that the semigroupoid generates. Okay, and the Fock space is the Hilbert space you just get by taking decreeing that you have an orthonormal basis vector for every element of F plus of G, everything in the semigroupoid. And so it's a generalized Fock space. I'm going to go through a number of examples, so I'll show you that explicitly, how you can see that. Okay. But and so whenever you have a Fock space, you have creation operators around, of course. Okay. And so here, the generalized creation operators are LE, we call them. Okay. And so for every directed edge, you have an LE. And so what LE does to one of these basis vectors is it it creates an E on the path W if G allows you to do that. Okay, so in other words, if the source of E, remember we're going right to left, if the source of E matches up with the range of W, okay, then it creates that vector. If that's not the case, then you annihilate. Okay, so they're partial isometries, generalized, if you like, they're partial creation operators. And then the corresponding family of projections px, you just multiply by an x, by vertex x, but in the semigroupoid relations, that just collapses to w when you're allowed to do it, when w ends up at the vertex x, xw is equal to x, or xw is equal to w. And so it's a projection, right? And so you annihilate when the range of w is different than x. So it's a projection. It's a projection onto all the words which correspond to paths that end at x. Okay. And so the family LEPX satisfy the dagger relations, but not the double dagger relations. They don't satisfy that last condition. They don't satisfy equality in that last condition. And in fact, they're the prototypical example of such a family. For every that's right. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So that's and any. If I have time, I'll mention the Wold decomposition later that indicate how they come up in the general theory. It turns out that there's a Wold decomposition, and basically these LEs play the role analogous to the unilateral shift. Okay. So I'll maybe come back to that if I have time. So I should also mention that these. So this is the notation I'm using, LEPX, but all of these, the LE, the PX, you can think of them as coming from the left regular representation, right, of the semigroupoid. So PX, you could also call LX, I guess, right? It multiplies by X. So it's really the left regular representation of F plus of G that we're looking at. And so the important non-self-adjoint algebras there, Steve Power and I call the free semigroupoid algebra. So generalizing the since it generalizes this idea of the free semigroup algebra of Davidson, Pitts, and others, and Popescu and others, so that's the non-self-adjoint weakly closed algebra generated by the LE and PX. Okay, and so I guess the list is growing of people who have worked on these algebras, and then the quiver algebras. Are the norm closed algebras, okay? And the different terminology comes from the fact that Muley Salel started looking at the quiver algebras a couple years before Steve and I started looking at these free semigroupoid algebras. And it was my and Steve's fault. So we didn't actually realize that that Muley Salel had started to look at the quiver algebras, doing different things than us. But anyway, that's the reason for the different terminology. And so the quiver algebra is the norm closed algebra generated by family LEPX. And so it's a generalized, if you like, and I'll give you examples, this is a generalized disk algebra, and this is a generalized H infinity. Okay.
There's overlap.
Is my point, yeah. There's non-trivial intersection, maybe. Yeah. And it's but the overlap, the non-trivial overlap is growing, and it may fill out the whole. It may make the sets coincide, eventually. Yeah, and maybe it already has. Pardon? Okay. I'll go through a number of examples and hopefully give you a flavor for what I think is the diversity. There's a large diversity of examples here, and so there are lots of finite dimensional examples, and you're going to get a finite dimensional algebra precisely when the graph itself is finite and has no cycles. Okay, so you're always going to get a finite dimensional a matrix algebra, basically. So in this case, if you have three vertices, two directed edges, then the Fock space is really just five dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, and E can go from, so I'm using different labeling here, but across the top, these three vectors across the top correspond to the three vertex vectors, the three vacuum vectors for the vertices, and then LE can map the first one to the second, and then that's it, and then and LF can map the first one to the third, vertex, and so that's it, and then everything else gets annihilated. So it's a five-dimensional space, and so it has five generators, three vertex projections, two partial isometries, and I mean X is just going to be a linear combination of those five. And if you just look at the decomposition, the matrix decomposition of this algebra, it has this form, and that's unitary equivalent to, or it's isomorphic to this algebra, which is a digraph algebra, okay, which is an example of a digraph algebra. Okay, and so I give the definition basically there, unital subalgebra of n by n matrices spanned by some matrix units. Well, you do actually have a commutant theorem, yeah. It turns out that the commutant of LG is given by the right regular representation, and so that's a great technical device. Yeah, yeah. Actually, I'll mention some results after the after going through some examples. Okay, so. And so here's I guess the motivating infinite dimensional examples, right? The first one, in the case of single vertex graphs, single directed edge, then you get your Fock space is just a single infinite stock, okay? And so you have your vacuum vector Cx and Le then can map it to Xe, and I mean you just keep following around that that single directed edge, and so what you're looking at here is really the unilateral shift. Right, so identify the Fock space HD with the Hardy space H2, and with that identification, LE is unitarily equivalent to the unilateral shift U plus, and then so LG is really the analytic Toeplitz algebra H infinity, and AG the quiver algebra is the disk algebra. Okay, and so the non-commutative analog of that, if you like, is the free semigroup algebra that I alluded to. So this is so you get this when you have single vertex, two directed edges. And so in that case, you're going to get the full unrestricted two-variable Fock space, right? So you have one vacuum vector for every vertex, okay? So one vacuum vector there. And what are you allowed to do? Well, you're allowed to do anything, right? You're allowed to follow E and then follow E or F. You're allowed to follow F and then either E or F, okay, and continuously. So you get the full unrestricted Fock space, two-variable Fock space there. And so so LG in that case, AG is the non-commutative analog of the disk algebra. LG is the analog of H infinity in this setting called the free semigroup algebra. So, as I said, mainly Davidson, Pitts, and Popescu developed the theory there. Okay, so those are motivating infinite dimensional examples, but there's a lot more. And so just for fun, let me show you some of them. Almost anything you write down gives you something neat. So if you take a single directed edge, single loop edge, and then add a second vertex and one edge over to it, then again, I'm using ones and twos to write the Fock space down, but there's the structure of the Fock space. You have a single single vacuum vector under the second vertex, where the second vertex is, and then you have an infinite dimensional one underneath the first vertex, vacuum vector. And so the algebra there, so it's generated by LE, LF, and P1, P2. And when you make the identification of the two range projections with the Hardy space H2, you get these 2x2 matrix decompositions. Remember, U plus is the unilateral shift. Okay, and so the algebra, when you look at what algebra you get, LG, you get this matrix function algebra. So H infinity multiples of the scalars and H infinity zeros, all the H infinity functions which annihilate the origin. assuming the connection there between the so the unilateral shift can be identified with the Toeplitz operator multiplication by Z. Okay. Well, if you add another edge, so add just one more edge to that example, you get something very different. Okay. So single loop edge, and then we're adding. So in this example, compared to the previous matrix function algebra, we're adding a single directed edge back from 2 to 1. And well, as you might expect, I mean, you've done a little thing, but you create a new, a very different algebra because you have now multiple cycles. Okay, and so you can see this in the Fock space structure now. Okay, you have a much richer structure in the Fock space structure in the Fock space diagram. And the algebra itself is very different, and it's generated by the LELF, LG, P1, P2, and in fact the algebra turns out to be what we call partly free, okay? In a sense that I should have time to make precise later. But the basic point is that it receives an injection of the free semigroup algebra L2, okay? And you can see that explicitly here because you can just write down two isometries in LG which have orthogonal ranges. So I'll say more about that. Pardon? You know, that's a clever observation. I gave this, or a version of this talk, in Virginia Tech, the colloquium. And after the talk, an algebraist came up to me and asked to see this example recently. And, so you're talking about the counting the number of paths. If you count the number of the number of vectors at each level, what that means, what that's equivalent to, is counting the number of paths. So at the kth level, you're counting the number of paths of length k, right? And if you do that, you get the kth Fibonacci number. So someone told me there is a journal called Fibonacci Quarterly or something. So if anyone wants to prove a theorem or something, you could submit it to directed graphs and the Fibonacci sequence. Little paper, right? Yeah, okay, so well, let me defer that. I'm gonna talk about that later. Yeah, so okay, so here's another example with, so this is a different generalization of H infinity, and it's maybe more of a direct generalization. Okay, so I originally wrote this slide when we had one perspective on this algebra, and then we realized a simpler perspective. But the point is, in general, you can have a single cycle with n directed edges and n vertices, right? And so we call that a cycle graph. The Fock space is going to be n infinite stalks, okay, and you can make so the algebra is generated by the LE1 up to LEN, and then the n vertex projections, and you're going to have a matrix. And so when you look at what you get a big matrix function algebra that you wouldn't just write that down out of the blue, of course, but somehow it's totally natural. These cycle graphs come up in the general theory, so the cycle graph algebras do. And actually, this is something that Steve and his postdoc realized after the fact, that this algebra is actually this is actually the weakly closed version of an algebra that's appeared. It's the weakly closed algebra generated by the norm closed semi cross product of D'Alba and Peters, given by the cyclic shift automorphism on CN. And so one more example, if you had to make an infinite graph generalization of this, one thing you might do is this. So a single line directed infinite path going off to infinity. So vertices indexed with the positive integers, and then a directed edge for each pair, and then plus one. Okay, and so the Fox space then is going to be an infinite string of infinite stocks. Okay, and so while these algebras are not they're the important example of algebras that are not partly free, this one is. Maybe a little bit surprisingly at first that it is, but so partly free again. I'll talk about that later. But the point is, you can get again a pair of isometries inside the algebra with orthogonal ranges. Here they are explicitly. And let me point out a true difference now with the departure from the quiver algebra case, where the quiver algebra contains no isometry. So the point is, you really do need those. You really do need weak convergence to get things in the algebra. And in general, that's true. When you have a countable graph, if you have bona fide infinite paths, so not just going around a cycle a bunch of times, if you have bona fide infinite paths in your algebra, generally LGU is going to be very different than AG, and actually this because of this, for example. Okay, so when did I start, by the way? 9.
Half an hour.
Okay. All right. So let me give you a sprinkling of some of the results that we've derived. And so again, this is sort of spread through joint works with Power, Katsoulis, and Jury. And so first of all, there is a commutant theorem. And so LG is its own double commutant. So the commutant of LG is RG, where RG is the weakly closed algebra generated by the right regular representation. Okay. Right regular representation determined by the partial creation operators on the right. Okay, so that's of course a great technical device. There's a Bierling invariant subspace theorem. So the Bierling theorem for H infinity says that every invariant subspace is the range of an isometry in the algebra. And so this is the appropriate analog here. If you have an invariant subspace for the algebra, then it's determined by a wandering subspace. Okay, so won't say much about that, but basically it's a direct sum. It's an orthogonal direct sum of cyclic subspaces. Okay, and every cyclic subspace is the range of a partial isometry in the commutant. Okay, so it's an analog of the H infinity case. There are lots of differences, though. I mean, for instance, you never get orthogonal direct sums with invariant subspaces for H infinity because the H infinity commutes, so any two invariant subspaces are going to intersect. Okay, so anyway, this is and so most directly this is a generalization of the free semigroup algebra case, LN, where you get this type of scenario. And in that case, you don't have partial isometries; you actually have isometries in the algebra. Okay, well, there's enough invariant subspaces around, and the Bierling theorem suggests this, that we prove that LG is reflexive. Okay, so. In other words, it can be obtained as the algebra generated by it's the algebra of operators that leave all the subspaces of LG invariant. Okay, so that's just what reflexive means. LG is equal to Algelat LG. So Stephen and his postdoc Frederick Jick proved that LG is hyperreflexive, so a stronger notion for a finite G. And so there's an open problem there, still open for countable G. That's right, yeah. And actually a plug for that. So Steve's giving the main talk in this little workshop, and he's planning to give a talk on his hyperreflexivity work. Okay. And here's another result it's sort of another useful technical device. That LG, well, if you assume G is no sinks, we proved, and that might be an artificial assumption, that LG satisfies property A1. Okay, and so there is property A1, basically that every weak star continuous functional can be realized as a vector functional. Okay, and so you can get mileage out of that. You can use it to get connections between invariant subspaces and ideals in the algebra. So you can use the invariant subspace structure to characterize the ideal structure. Okay. Another example, a couple more examples. LG, so So the free semigroup algebras are have no radical. They're semi-simple. In general, though, depending on your directed graph, LG is going to have radical, and so we nail down exactly when it does. So LG is semi-simple, has no radical when G is transitive in each component. And so basically that means that so a component is a maximal collection of vertices and edges in the undirected graph, okay? And a transitive in that component means that from every pair of vertices in there, you can get a directed path in both directions. Okay, so that's transitive. And so that turns out to be equivalent to semi-simple, and basically and we showed that in general the radical is generated by the partial isometries coming from directed edges that sort of join these transitive components. So if you have two transitive components and if you have a directed edge that goes from one to the other, but you can't get back to the other one, then that partial isometry is in the radical. And those partial isometries determine the structure of the radical. And in fact, in the finite vertex case, you can actually explicitly the radical is the weakly closed ideal generated by those things, and it's nilpotent. It's nilpotent of degree bounded above by the number of vertices in the algebra. Okay, and another thing we knocked off. We were having some fun with free products. We just looked at a simple case when you have two graphs and they intersect. If they have a common vertex, okay, and then you can make sense. So then you can join the two graphs together at that vertex, create a bigger graph, and you can make sense of this free product where you amalgamate over the span of that single corresponding vertex projection that's in both algebras, right? And and the point there is you just trace through the Voigt-Ulescu free product definition of Hilbert spaces and use the explicit Fock space constructions you have here. And you just have to write it down to see that. Okay, and then there's the classification. Okay, so classification, well, you know what the theorem is. The theorem should be that these algebras depend on the graph, right? And that's the case, and actually this now has a little history. But first of all, this is very different from the C-star algebra case. So the C-star algebra case, not so. Right, so like C star of G, different G's can give the same C star of G. Okay, so there are different G's, for instance, that give non-isomorphic G's that give the compact operators a C star of G. So, but in the non-self-adjoint case, and that's one of the selling points, that you can prove these strong results that connect the algebras with the directed graph. But still, anyway, we'll stop there. So the so there's a little history on this. Then, so Steve and I proved that these twiddles mean for the algebras mean unitary equivalence. So I guess we actually proved it in 2001. And then just late last year, Elias and I were doing a paper, and we called it "Isomorphisms of Algebras Associated with Directed Graphs" or something. And So we proved that actually the graph is invariant up to Banach algebra isomorphism, and independently, almost at the same time, Solel came out with a paper, fortunately for us, with a weaker theorem, but we're all going to get published, so it's no big deal. So he classified them up to isometric isomorphism. And isometric isomorphism of the algebras, the algebra structures, and so I mean, so explicitly what I mean is, so for instance, for this result, LG and actually AG, so LG is unitarily equivalent to LG prime if and only if G and G prime are isomorphic as directed graphs, so the strongest possible connection between the directed graphs.
Yeah.
It almost is. There's algebra isomorphism. That's no, it's not. No, it's not. There's algebra isomorphism. Algebra.
Why don't I topological algebra isomorphism?
But you can ask about, okay, so that, and that was my next remark that I didn't write here, that Elias and I actually proved that if you make an initial constraint on the graph, and it's a finiteness condition, it's not too severe, you can actually show that the graph is an invariant for algebra isomorphism. So forgetting topologies, forgetting norms, just pure algebra. So I guess that's as good as you can get. We did have to make a finiteness condition on the graph, though. That's right, yeah, because I guess basically, yeah, if you do it in one algebra, if the Quiver algebras are isomorphic, then what you're doing on one hand, on the one hand, is being mimicked in the other, I guess, or can be described in the other. No, that's right now. So partly free. Okay, so let me formalize that a bit. So this is a neat little sidebar. So partly free algebras then, the question we asked was, this is now Power and I, we asked when you can inject L2 into LG, can you describe it in terms of G, right? Can you describe it in terms of simple properties, the underlying directed graph, when you can inject it? And so if you like, you can think of this as a non-self-adjoint analog of asking when you can inject O2 into a C-star algebra. The free group on two generators into a discrete group. Okay, it's a non-self-adjoint analog of that. And so, when can you do that? Well, certainly, if you have inside your directed graph, if you have a vertex with two loop edges over it, you can do that. I mean, just take the actual partial isometries themselves, LE and LF, and the weakly closed algebra. That's a subalgebra of LG. And when you cut down, it's actually unitarily equivalent to L2. More generally, it turns out that you can also do it when. If there's more than one vertex, this would be a non-unital injection. Okay, but still, you can inject in the algebra. But more generally, if your graph contains a vertex with two distinct cycles of minimal length, okay, so W1 and W2, such that they're not one's not a power of the other, okay, over the same vertex, and they're distinct, then the weakly closed algebra generated by the LW1, okay, the product of all the LE that make up W1, gives you that the algebra generated by LW1 and LW2 gives you a copy of L2 that you can inject. And LG, so we say that when G has that, G has a double cycle. And it turns out there are these other things that we discovered, and motivated by that example, where you have a single infinite path with directed edges corresponding to each positive integer, pair of positive integers. And in fact, that turns out to be a general phenomenon. So whenever you have a situation in your graph where you have a single vertex and then you have an infinite non-overlapping path, directed path that emanates from it, okay, inside the graph, then you can get a pair of isometry, or, well, they're going to be partial isometries if there's more than one vertex, but partial isometries give you a non-unital injection of L2 into the algebra. So say that G contains an infinite non-overlapping path, okay, when that happens. And so the theorem is that that's it. I mean, those are the only two cases. And the case that came up before was when actually there were two. There was one example of each before. So the example here was when you had two vertices, a loop edge over one, and then directed edge. So in that case, you have, over this vertex, you have a double cycle. And then the other example was vertices indexed by the positive integers and directed edges going out to infinity. Okay, so that's an example of the... And so in both of those cases, you can get a unital embedding. Or no. You can get a unital embedding in that case. But, yeah. So the theorem is that that's it, okay? So, and in a nutshell, this aperiodic infinite path property is either G contains a double cycle over an edge or over a vertex or an infinite non-overlapping path. And to get a unital injection, basically, so the uniform aperiodic infinite path property means that you have this situation over every vertex in the graph. Okay, you have one of these two scenarios over every vertex in the graph. And so I won't say anything about this last thing, but you can connect it with some other properties. Actually, maybe it is worth mentioning. It's kind of cute that the right radial representation RG, the algebra determines, is naturally unitary equivalent to the LG you get when you take G and reverse all the directions of the directed edges. So that's what I mean by G transpose. G transpose you get from G by reversing the directions of all the directed edges. The LG you get there, so LG transpose is unitarily equivalent to RG, turns out. Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly what it does. Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Saves me from writing out more, basically. Yeah. Okay, well, I guess that's all I wanted to say, and just some general rambling on this last slide about, you know, possible other things to do. So we looked at LG, AG for countable directed graphs G. I mean, that's the theme of what we're doing, but we haven't thought about uncountable, and surely you get differences there, but I mean, you know, can you prove non-trivial extensions of these results that we have to uncountable G? There's also, and this is mainly something I've done with Jury, Mike Jury, who's more of a classically trained operator theorist, and so we've been we've been working on the operator theory type approach to these LGs. So viewing these LEs as generalizations of the unilateral shift, you can prove a Wohl decomposition. So Jury and I proved that, and also Muley and Salel actually got to prove that Wohl decomposition for in the Hilbert module setting, and so some other we proved some other von Neumann inequality in particular, we proved among other things. So there's a number of things you can, I think, still to be done. There's also natural weighted shifts here. So I've looked at these weighted shifts you get in a special case where you have a single vertex and say two directed edges. And so what you look at there are the weighted shifts are weighted left creation operators, right? And you can prove results there that generalize standard weighted shifts. No one's really looked at the weighted shifts that you get for general directed graphs. Okay, and so this is a nice question that Baruch Salel asked me. So on this partly free theme, so that was basically asking when characterize G, describe what conditions on G you need for there to be an injection of L2, into LG. But more generally, ask when can you? So given, maybe I should say given H. You know, given a directed graph H, when can you inject LH into LG? So getting conditions on G, so somehow it should be that there is you can see H inside G somehow, right? Well, for L2 we proved it in both cases, so if you could do one, I'm sure you could do the other. Well, I'm not sure, obviously, but be my guess. Okay, so this last condition is just. I wrote it when I was very tired. So it turns out that in one of the candidate theories for a grand unified theory, you have string theory and then you have loop quantum gravity. So loop quantum gravity is kind of going up, trying to go from to link relativity and quantum mechanics by going up from quantum mechanics to meet relativity. And it turns out that in some of the work there, the framework. The directed graph operator algebra framework is being used. It's there, I'm starting to talk to people about it, but I have nothing to report there. Other than it's always nice to get the word quantum into your talk once, if possible. So that's it.